Hello, everyone. It's Scott Carley here, and it's March the 5th, 2013, and this is our Climate Literacy Network call for the day. So I'm assuming everyone is back. Hello?
Hi.
Oh, good. I was wondering whether I just canceled everything out. Good. So, as we usually do, are there any announcements today that we want to pass along to everyone?
Yeah, this is Mark McCaffrey with the National Center for Science Education.
Yeah.
And as I think a lot of you know, the draft of the National Climate Assessment is out for review right now, and the U.S. Global Change Research Program, which is kind of the coordinating body for the 13 federal agencies that are part of the, you know, part of the U.S. Global Change Research Program and have been involved with developing this national climate assessment, it has education and communication as one of its strategic goals. And so I've been looking at this draft of the national climate assessment, which will be finalized next year, and there's a public comment period open for another couple of weeks, and education is basically missing almost entirely from the draft assessment. So we have an opportunity as a community sort of involved with climate and energy literacy to weigh in, and in particular what we're looking for are kind of peer review type of evidence, in other words, papers that we can point them to that demonstrate the importance of education in addressing the climate and energy challenges that we face. So if anybody's interested, I could share a link to some of the notes I've put together. I've got it up as a Google Docs, basically drawing from this draft and pointing out some of the language that's related to education, communication, and outreach. As I say, it's pretty thin, and the people that put the draft assessment together generally just don't have a background in these areas. You know, I think there's a bit more about communication, the importance of clear communication, engaging stakeholders, decision makers, but there's really no recognition of the value of education to, you know, inform, say, the 76 million people that are currently in school. Again, I think there's a lot of potential for us to contribute to this current draft by making recommendations of how they can fill these gaps around education before they finalize the National Climate Assessment next year.
Mark, this is Scott. Do you feel it would be stronger for this, is, you know, for the Climate Literacy Network as a group to respond to that, or do you think a series of individual response to this will?
Well,
carry?
Yeah, I mean, whatever works. The public comment period goes until April 13th, I believe.
Okay.
So the clock is ticking. We don't have a lot of time.
Right.
And we've talked about maybe having one of the Climate Literacy Network calls focus on discussing what we might do to build, mm-hmm. you know, to put in some public comments. But I don't know if there's time between now and April to do that. Since
we certainly do have some spots at the beginning of April.
Okay.
So let's talk about that. Session where we can have a discussion. This is real important.
I think so.
I'm curious whether folks are comfortable with Mark sharing that Google Doc link with the entire listserv. Are people fine with that?
Yes, that'd be great.
Okay, just, you know, we're trying not to overload folks with so many things, but I think this is really important. Good.
Okay, so I'll go ahead and send that out.
Yeah, that would be great, Mark. Thank you. Are there any other questions or announcements? Well, I know Austin was just asking for just a little sort of overview of what the Climate Literacy Network is, and see if I can do it in do my, well, not even an elevator speech, see if I can do it in a couple of sentences. this has been a group that's been around for, I guess, about, 4 years or so. And our focus, and as Mark kind of suggested in his comments, our focus has really been on the education side. There's lots of climate science going on there, but we're really interested in climate science education. One of the products that came out of this group is climate literacy document. We've been really active in putting together sessions at various national meetings, particularly the American Geophysical Union meeting. And the other thing we've also done is there's been several projects that have come out of collaborations that have been sparked by members of this network. So there's been quite a bit of work done with that. We have lots of good partners at NOAA and NASA, and PEG, of course, is at NOAA, and who I know is on the line. I'm sure there's others here, too. Frank Niefold is off and on, too. So that's kind of we're folks who are very interested in climate science education, and increasingly we have been including energy in all of that, and here's the nice segue. That's part of why we invited Austin to talk today, is as the energy literacy document came together and supplemented some of the work that many of us were doing, it's become really clear that we need to be talking about climate and energy at the same time. So we put a call out to folks who are doing more energy work, and Austin agreed to talk with us today about the building industry transportation electrical scenarios tool that National Renewable Energy Lab has been developing. So, Austin, I'm kind of jumping right into his bio here. He's the senior analyst at the Washington, D.C. It sounds like an increasingly snowbound office in D.C. of the of NREL. And his work focuses on clean transportation, including efficient and electrified vehicles, renewable fuels, and transportation system intersections with the built environment. And Austin, welcome. I'm so glad that you're offered to talk with us. And I'm going to let you sort of introduce how we want to try to do this using WebEx. As some folks may know, there's been a little bit of confusion about getting the slides in the right places. We've had some problems with the website not updating, and I did send out the slides. But we may find it easier to do it using WebEx. So if you can introduce that and jump right in, that would be great.
Great. Thanks a lot, Scott. I really appreciate the chance to chat about the tool here, and I'd love to get feedback from this group. I guess for my reference, so is there anyone on the call who has neither the slides nor is in the WebEx? I will hope for silence on that, because then I would have to do some very good visual descriptions of what we're looking at. So I see there's several people in the WebEx. Is there anyone who has not been able to get in but is following along on the slides? And that's fine. I'll just provide more notes as I go.
Austin, I do have a question about I'm looking at WebEx and I'm on the phone. Should I be getting audio out of the WebEx?
No, I didn't set up the audio because we had this phone line. So the WebEx should just be it should just say bytes and be the front page of the web page right now.
Great. And this is being recorded. Is it being recorded with? I'm teaching a climate change class, and we're on energy, so this is really perfect. I'm just wondering if it's something that the visuals recorded as well, so I could show it to them, share it with them.
I have not been recording it. I will start a recording right now, so that if you can manage the syncing up, then that would probably work.
Terrific. Thanks. Appreciate it.
You may find that depending on where we go with this discussion, you may find that the intro video on the website is more focused for the class or some of the other materials, but you're welcome to use this in your class if that would be helpful. And I'll start recording now.
Thank you.
Well, thanks, Austin, for that. Yeah, we can see you're doing it. it is your desktop.
Good. Yep. Okay. So it sounded like most people then have been able to get into the WebEx and see the screen, because that'll make life a little easier. I mean, I'll go through it slide by slide, and then it's mainly the demo where I thought it'd be useful to have it, so we don't have to worry about everybody trying to get their login working live. So feel free to yell at me as we go if I'm like jumping over stuff or if I'm confusing, or if you just want clarification. I'd love to get just a good dialogue going on. And I thought today I would go over a quick overview and history of Bytes, sort of how we got here. It's kind of a strange story of trying to repurpose some analysis we did. Then a quick demo of the tool, and then ways that we have for educators or others to be who are interested in the tool to get involved, and then any discussion and questions that we haven't covered this time around. By way of who I am, so Scott, thanks for the introduction. My day job is mostly working as an energy analyst, which doesn't have an explicit educational component. I sort of see education as a maybe somewhere in between hobby and job, in that I try to find ways to incorporate it into my life or semi-professional life as I go. Most recently, that's involved teaching a class at the D.C. campus of Johns Hopkins on transportation energy policy, but then also more generally just trying to get as involved as I can in the wonderful energy literacy stuff going on in Department of Energy right now, which is, as Scott said, how I got connected to this group. So it's just an interest area of mine to figure out how we can use the data and analysis that we work on over here in our daily lives to actually improve the educational resources available to the rest of the community. Any questions before I jump right into the overview? Nope. Okay. So energy use in the United States is very complicated, and the main reason I would throw these double pie charts up is to just point out that there's a lot of different ways to slice and dice energy before you even start to think about the impacts on climate. On the left chart, I'm dividing energy use up by sector, so transportation, residential buildings, commercial buildings, and industrial use. And then the dark wedges are direct use, so things like burning natural gas, and the lighter parts of the wedges are the energy used to generate electricity that's used in that sector. And then on the right is the same amount of energy, but where that energy comes from. So we get it from a bunch of different sources, notably petroleum, coal, and natural gas, but also nuclear, biomass, wind, hydroelectric, and some other renewables that are in there and growing pretty quickly. So this system is really pretty massively complex. And we find that energy is both essential and very, very confusing, often for people who ostensibly work in energy professionally. We also find that the media ends up with a bunch of different pros and cons for a bunch of different energy options, and then sort of assumes that people, that individuals, will be able to sort out those options when deciding for themselves what they want to engage in, either on their own lives or politically. And from that, we feel that learning about this complex system and exploring the impact and combinations of different options is really important. But it's very hard for somebody to do for themselves, to go out and look at the massive amounts of data on the energy that we use in the United States and try to come up with an assessment of what the real options are. This actually rears its head very much in the daily work that we do for the Office of Energy Efficiency and Renewable Energy. So that's the part of Department of Energy that does applied energy R&D in energy efficiency and in renewable energy. And it's composed of 10 different programs, which I'm graphically representing here by the size of their budgets, which is not intended to be a proxy for how important the technologies are, just how much money has been recently invested in them. And the green dots here are the renewable energy side of the house, the blue dots are the energy efficiency, and then the orange dots are the deployment activities. And, you know, not to go into all of the different ins and outs of what the office does, I know that's not what this call is for, but the office is itself making a variety of choices between investments in the supply and the demand side of energy, as well as transportation, and then making priority investments between different technologies that work in those supply and demand sides. So it's a really complex system to try to manage. How do we think about the impact of working on appliance standards, making air conditioners better on the same scale as making a solar panel cheaper? These are all things that the office does, but we need some tools to be able to integrate those different impacts in those different areas. That is, strategically, the office cares about stuff like energy saved, CO2 emissions reduced, petroleum use avoided, that come out of each of these different programs, but we need to do some work to be able to talk about all of these impacts on the same terms. So that's a large part of what my daily analyst job is about, and we built some tools to be able to handle that. So I said EERE has diverse goals and lots of stuff. we developed some tools, originally a spreadsheet-based tool, to combine the impacts of technology development and deployment in each of these programs, to be able to combine it into a picture of what we expect the office to be able to achieve in a variety of different impacts, like the ones that I mentioned, and including, perhaps I would say recently, even a focus on the ability of the combination of these technologies and efforts to reduce CO2 emissions. So this is all upstream of Bytes. This is all the work we've been doing over the last few years to try to improve our decision-making at Department of Energy. We also found that the team working on this, which includes me, just learned a lot about energy. We learned a lot about these obscure uses of energy. We learned a lot about some of the trade-offs that you have to make between the different energy sectors. We learned that you can't get to very big impacts in CO2 emissions unless you take a concerted approach across different sectors. And at the end of this, you know, as we took a step back and took a deep breath, we realized that the tools we developed actually would be probably useful in some form for the general public and for educational purposes. But it was by that point a gigantic, very confusing Excel spreadsheet that only a handful of us really knew our way around. So our solution was to develop the Buildings, Industrial, Transportation, and Electricity Scenarios tool, which has as its guts, as its engine, the same tools that we developed working for the Office of Energy Efficiency and Renewable Energy, but has a user interface that's more relatable for individuals to be able to use with only a little bit of training, but then also all of the deep functionality if people want to expand and get further into the weeds. So some examples of what you can do. So we call it Bytes because it does work in these four sectors, and I've got some examples on the slides of impacts you can put into the tool to examine their effect on the output. So that includes things like building codes, appliance efficiency, industrial efficiency, light-duty vehicle efficiency, which is things like more efficient cars and personal light trucks, renewable fuels, how many miles each vehicle drives, and then the electricity mix. And in all, the full version of the tool has something like 400 different inputs, and we also developed a more relatable, what we call basic version, that's just around 10 inputs. I think it's 12 exactly. Inputs for users to try out and experiment with. So are there questions on sort of how we got here? I don't want to get too beleaguered with details, but I'd be happy to take any questions on the context of the tools we developed before I jump into a quick demo.
Carry on.
Yeah. Hello? Go on? Okay, I'll assume that silence is... I'll assume that silence is affirmation.
Yes.
Okay, so now I'm switching over to my web browser. Can everybody see the front page of the tool where it says get started in the middle here?
Yep.
So the first thing I'm going to do is log in. You don't have to log in to view the scenarios, but you do have to log in order to make your own scenario. And what I see here is immediately a list of a variety of different scenarios. We start with the featured scenarios at the top, and these are some key scenarios that we think users might have an interest in. This is a combination of the baseline, which is the starting point for a lot of the scenarios we do, some scenarios we've developed working from different studies. So, for example, the Reinventing Fire scenario is based on the Rocky Mountain Institute's very cool book and scenario study of the same name. And you as a user can go in and explore the inputs and the outputs that they got from that study and even make your own version. So as we go, we hope to develop more of these featured scenarios. Below that is the list of my personal scenarios, so anyone else logged in wouldn't see these except the ones that I've made and then shared with the world. And then below that is the set of shared scenarios that's really any user can, after making a scenario, share it publicly. So I noticed since the last time I've been in here, we've got a variety of new users trying out a bunch of different things. I don't know who Team Moscow is, but I hope they learned something interesting. Some of these are left over from class workshops that we've run, and then a variety of them are just ones from interested people who've used it and shared their scenario. So for now, I'm going to create a new scenario so that we can play around with a few things. I'll call it our CLN test scenario. I'm going to leave the input mode in basic to avoid putting everybody into information overload. We expect that the vast majority of users, at least at first, will start in basic mode. And then I can provide a description here to remind me what I was trying to do when I was creating the scenario or to encode my goals or other things. So now I've created this scenario, and it'll appear in my scenarios list here at the bottom. I can edit the details that I just saw there. I can delete the scenario, and I can look at some additional scenario info that I'll show you after we make some changes. So I'm going to open the scenario up, and this takes me to the basic mode interface. We can make changes, as I said, in four different sectors. So I've got it defaults to buildings. I can also pull it over to industry, transportation, and electricity. And these have each of the inputs in those sectors that are the tools available to me as a user to experiment with the energy system. Each of these, of course, is glossing over a bunch of different inputs and choices that we've had to make in building the model. That's why we have the advanced mode for anyone who wants to really get into how those how these top-level decisions, like what the miles per gallon of the light-duty vehicle fleet might be translated into, you know, what cars are actually on the road. And that's the sort of thing that you'd need to use the advanced mode to figure out. So before I make any changes, I'm going to show you what the output screen looks like. When teaching with this tool, I find this is a great place to start because when you start out, the output screen will be representative of our baseline. And our baseline is based off of the Energy Information Administration's annual energy outlook. That's their annual report of where they expect the United States energy future to go if there's no significant changes in policy or technology beyond what's expected in their model. So since I haven't made any changes, I don't have any reductions. When I do, we'll see those appear here at the top. But there's a variety of other charts on the left that I can run through, both at the summary level and then in each of the sectors. I can look, for example, at the total emissions by end-use sector. So this shows me from now until 2050 how many CO2 emissions we expect from the buildings, industrial, and transportation sector, here where electricity is spread out between those three sectors. And I can call electricity out as its own emissions by going to this total emissions by sector instead to view that alternatively. We can look at how much energy is delivered to each of these sectors. And again, none of these plots are going to look particularly interesting because we're starting out at the baseline, but it's still a great way to learn things like how much each sector uses in terms of primary energy, where we get primary energy in the U.S. So I love this chart because it shows you how much you get from petroleum, nuclear, natural gas, coal, wind, solar, and then these other sources. And then if, for example, I wanted to look down at only the renewables, I can tack off these fossil sources, and the chart will update to only show me the renewable sources so I can compare the baseline deployment of these other technologies and see that we're really talking about some wind, quite a bit of hydro, and a lot of biomass in the baseline. And that would be the sort of thing that a user would then potentially be interested in exploring further outside of the tool. So I won't show any more of these outputs now, but we'll go through a few more after I run through a simple scenario. So I'm just going to play around with a couple of different options. I feel today like working in the transportation sector for no particular reason, but maybe I think that 38 miles per gallon, which is the baseline, isn't nearly enough, and I think we need to up our CAFE to 65 miles a gallon. And again, maybe I have a reason for thinking this. Maybe I just want to try it out. There's no reason to be too cautious about exploring. Maybe I also think 13,500 miles is kind of an absurd amount for me to need to drive every year, and I can maybe keep with the approximate current number of about 12,000. We give a little bit of context in tooltips, so if I didn't know what to pick, I could mouse over that and we'd see, oh, okay, it's about 12,000 today and projected to increase, but some sources suggest that maybe it could decrease. So maybe I think, okay, 12,000, actually we could all go with 1,000 miles less a year than where we're at today. Maybe I don't want to increase any additional biofuels, but I think heavy trucks and stuff in this what we call non-light-duty vehicle can get 20% more efficient. So I'm sort of rushing through some decisions that in a classroom or a personal use context I'd want to take a little bit more seriously, and I've gone ahead and saved my scenario. Let's do changes to one more sector, so I'm going to jump over to the electricity sector and bump down coal, I think, from 48 to maybe 20%. And this is all by 2050, so we'll see what sort of impacts that would have. And then I'm going to make up for that in a combination of natural gas, and renewables. So I'll go to, so that's 60, 76. So I need to go to 24 here to make that 100%. And it will yell at me if I don't make that 100%. Keep me honest. Looks like we got a little visual confusion going on. But okay, so now I'm going to see what I did. So I just made some broad brush changes to the U.S. energy system. I'm going to go ahead and regenerate those outputs. It's running the model to see what those impacts were. And right away I can see that because of those changes, by 2050 I made a 28% reduction in CO2, a 12% reduction in the energy use, and a 35% reduction in oil use. And then this is a great time to think about, well, why is my oil use reduction so much bigger? And then I can think, oh, actually I made a lot of changes in transportation, which uses a lot of the oil. So I can go over to this oil consumption graph and see that I'm bringing my transportation oil use down by 2050 because of those changes that I made. If I don't remember where I started, I can go back to the bench. I can go to this benchmarking output. I can see just how much my case, the CLN test case, made from the baseline in terms of million metric tons of CO2 emissions, in terms of how much came from transportation. The building sector, for example, is unchanged because I didn't change anything in that sector. I can look at energy consumption, how it changed, petroleum consumption, and how the electric demand changed. I noticed something here that my electric demand increased a little bit, so I might be curious why that is. I could go explore maybe in the transportation sector and find that I've brought in a bunch, and sorry, I'm just sort of jumping around from chart to chart. I appreciate this is probably a little bit scattershot, but here we go anyway. The vehicle stock, and see that we're bringing in a bunch of advanced technology vehicles like plug-in hybrid cars that are going to be using additional electricity. But then I can see exactly what the impact of that is in this additional demand, in the electricity demand, and see this transportation sector electricity demand coming up here in this chart. So this is the sort of thing where I'm easily bumping through it because I've been using this for a while. It's the output screens, you know, are best handled by kind of a random walk around to find the different ones that are the most useful for any individual question that you might ask. We tried to err on the side of providing more outputs rather than less, and then letting users figure out which of these they find the most interesting. So back to the summary, I can see what changes I've made, and I could then go back, and if I thought I didn't get far enough or if I wanted to evaluate these other sectors, I could implement changes in those as well. I should say that when I say emissions, the scope of this tool is United States CO2 emissions from energy-related CO2 emissions only. So we, at the beginning of scoping the tool development, we didn't include things like methane and other agricultural emissions.
Right.
And that was just because that was the sort of the area in which we were working. That's not to say, obviously, to this group that we don't think those emissions are important. It was just a scope question. So I think that's the whirlwind demo I wanted to go through. I have a few more notes on how we're looking to deploy this and what sort of ways we see this as potentially being useful. But are there any questions or thoughts from folks? Anything else you'd like me to run through before we go on?
Austin, you may want to address this question later instead of now, and that's fine. What I'm very excited about is how you have taken an incredibly complex process and brought it into the realm where I think people can actually manipulate and play with it and see the results in a visually easy way to understand. So what I can see from a climate change point of view is the possibility of applying the process that you went through to create this tool and look at the various aspects of CO2 and go ahead and include methane and other greenhouse gases as well, but be looking at the various inputs, outputs regarding CO2, because we'll be needing to look at not just the connection to the energy picture, but also technologies which might remove the current levels of CO2 from the atmosphere. So the question is one about transferring the process by which you created the tool to those who would be looking at CO2 and climate change in particular.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, where I think we see this as a pretty good representation of the energy part of the system, and so you could imagine using this in concert with other tools, or potentially even building onto it something to track the other impacts. You know, we do it's sort of energy, but from our use case, we do have a pretty strong focus on the CO2 emissions part and really looking at potential emissions by year under these different scenarios. I think that the point you make about other emissions and then potentially things like forestry or other land use issues is a great one. The other sort of obviously missing component of this is the international perspective, and we're actively looking for ways to make this useful as a component of the whole international picture as well. So I just would generally agree that those are worthwhile things to think about going forward.
I would concur that this is a great tool because visually it's very clean, and it's you've broken down the different outputs so you can really learn from just playing with it, which I think is great. I just had a question about clarification. Under buildings, you don't that doesn't include building the buildings. It's operating the buildings, right? There's no cement or anything like that in buildings.
So just because of how the data source that we use, which is from the Energy Information Administration, is tracked. All of the upstream emissions, and this is true in general. So for building cars, for building buildings, for building appliances, everything is all somewhere in the industrial sector. So all the emissions are there. The problem is you don't see, for example, you can't go into the buildings and say build this with less material and then have fewer emissions in industry. But if you look at the emissions by subsector, that would probably end up somewhere in this other manufacturing. We have cement called out as its own component. Again, this is you know, just looking at the energy related CO2 emissions from that. So you wouldn't necessarily see all of the emissions from industry, but you do at least have that tracked in the tool, and you can, for example, look at efficiency improvements in industries. You could, in the advanced version, go in and actually make subsector-specific changes. So, for example, if we could reduce the demand for cement by a certain amount, you could sort of work that in, but not in this basic version. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, and I know that's a really complex thing, and it's hard to describe, right? Because we want to sort of attribute that to the car, if you're building a car. But the way that the data is, it's in industry, and you don't want to, you know, count it twice. So it probably shows up in different parts of industry because we have the iron and steel to go into the car, and then the manufacturing component, and then all the other non-manufacturing stuff that exists in the economy to support the other parts of the things that we do. You know, but I think at least the data is here to show what those total upstream impacts are, right? People tend to forget that we have a whole industrial sector supporting our lifestyle, not even to mention the stuff that we import, which is not included here. And so I think it can be, you can use it as the basis for a discussion, although we don't have the ability to do quite what you described with it.
Great.
Austin, this is Scott. I'm just sort of carrying on with that notion. Is there a way to actually see some of the models, the kinds of relationships that are being used here?
Sure. So for the very, very, very masochistic, the easiest way to do that is to download the spreadsheet version of the model, which we have in the help page. It's there. You can see exactly the logic that goes into it. Usually, it's logically simple because of the way we're structuring the inputs, right? If you do an efficiency improvement, it just reduces the energy demand for something. Yeah. And then the hard part is knowing what inputs that are sensible to use. But you know, it's easy to say it's in principle simple. We're dealing with hundreds of inputs and hundreds of outputs, and so it can be pretty daunting to follow unless somebody really, really, really wants to get into it.
I'm assuming just because of the way you showed it, that when you make a change to something, you know, a certain level at 2050, that it's in fact a linear slope to that level. Is that how there's no complexity in the terms of how we move from from where we are in 2013 to 2050. It's just a straight line slope.
That's right. And we usually track 2030 and 2050. One other thing that can help a little bit to understand how things flow, we do have a flow diagram that's more conceptual of how the information is combined. So we start with the AEO reference case. This is actually 2011, not 2010 now. We add in the user inputs, so the things in gold are things chosen by the user. Then we can see the way that the sectors talk to one another. They combine to provide an electric demand to the electric generation sector, and then those all add up the different outputs by sector. So this is a little bit, and then we have maps for each of these sectors, sort of how it looks. It's still fairly daunting for a new user to come into, so we don't lead with this. But for people who really want to understand the logical flow of the tool, this might be one step better than the insanity of trying to navigate somebody else's very detailed very detailed Excel spreadsheet.
But what's the power of this is if some of us are putting together a multi-day class or something like that, a multi-week, the potential to actually go in and understand how these sectors were modeled and then see the impact of it when we use the scenario tool.
Absolutely. And actually, so unless there's more direct questions, that's actually a great transition into some of our goals that we have for the project for educational use. This is, you know, always a working list. So I one of the main reasons I want to host things like this is to get feedback from your community on other ways that we could be using this or other use cases that you see. Does that make sense? Then we can circle back for questions at the end again.
Good.
Yep.
Great. Okay. So we have a few goals. So I've demoed this now at about five or six workshops of different sorts, mostly college or graduate students, and mostly with an interest or sort of some pre-existing knowledge about energy. So we have some goals that we've condensed out of that from hearing what the students were hoping to get out of these sessions and what they got out of them. The first one is pretty simple. Where do we get energy and where do we use energy in the U.S. and where do the emissions come from? This is something that's actually, I think, incredibly important and that is very underrepresented in the population in general, just knowing where we get energy. For example, few people, and we saw this in the energy literacy goals that Scott referenced, we know that many people think of electricity as a source of energy rather than as a carrier of energy and don't understand it doesn't just come out of the ground that way. We want to experiment with options to change the energy future of the U.S., so I really like to emphasize the experimental nature of this. You can't break anything, so you just go in and try a bunch of different levels and see what happens. We hope that users will explore the trade-offs between sectors and individual technologies, that is, looking at what if you work in buildings versus if you work in electricity versus if you work in both. We hope that users can generate a realistic cross-sector scenario that meets some of their energy and carbon emission targets. So we use these tools to try and assess the kinds of actions we would need to take to get to, for example, 80% reduction in energy-related CO2 emissions. And then most importantly, and this is the real reason to do this in a classroom environment, we find that it's an effective way for students to share their learning with each other and encourage them to discuss and compare and justify their selected scenarios to one another. And that goal is a large part of why we formatted the workshops the way that we have so far. We've got a pilot curriculum that's just basically encoded what we've done so far. It's by no means the only way that you could do it. We take a little bit at the beginning to go over U.S. energy use to try and give some of that context and some of the societal context on the importance of dealing with climate change and the importance of providing energy services both in the U.S. and worldwide. That can really be whatever an instructor wants it to be, of course. We like to start then after that with a quick demo of the tool so that users are at least a little bit familiar with how to navigate it. Then we break students up into groups, usually four groups, one for each sector. And they're restricted then to working only in that sector, and we provide a variety of sort of interesting materials in case the students don't feel like they have an understanding of what could be done in that sector. And we encourage the students to try to reach some of these energy and climate goals by working only in their one sector. And then they'll also, at the same time, this is my favorite part about this, they'll become the expert on that sector very quickly just by working with themselves in the group, you know, being familiar with learning about the different outputs, learning about what the energy use in that sector looks like. Then we mix up, we remix the groups so that it's new groups with at least one representative from each of the sectors. So we might have, for example, and I've got a graphical representation of this, if we had 16 students, we like to do 4 in each of the sector groups and then remix it into 4 goal-oriented groups to look at the whole system so that there's one in each group from each sector. And that way the students come into it as the expert on one sector and bring that knowledge that they got working in the sector to their group to work on the scenario as a whole. Those groups then come up with a combined scenario that attempts to reach the goals that they've set out for themselves at the beginning of the exercise. After that, the last portion is just a presentation by the different groups who choose a representative to go over the choices they made and the outputs they achieved. And then when there's time at the end, then followed by constructive criticism and discussion of how plausible each of these different components might be and the risk factors and the challenges of achieving them. And then lastly, the goal, the reach goal that we've probably got about a 50% success rate on so far is to come up with a class consensus. We find that some aspects of the scenarios will have emerged in each of the groups, and this is different every class we've done it in, but they'll often agree with each other in some things and disagree with each other in others. And so we will try to get representatives from the groups together to hammer out a potential consensus scenario, and if there is no dissent, then we can represent that consensus scenario on the website as a shared scenario as an output of the class's work, so they can go look at the outcome that their class came up with. We provide a bunch of pre-lessons, pre-readings, and other studies that we think are useful context for this as well. That's the general workshop we do. If you're interested in getting further involved, this is a great time. We're still considering this to be a live beta and looking for ways to improve it going forward. We have an educators group that we're forming. It's just really a glorified email list to get access to the newest draft curricula and then be able to share amongst each other different sorts of materials. We found that some instructors are going way off of the script, which I love because it means that they're adapting the tools used for specific classes with different levels of pre-existing knowledge or different needs or different interests. And I'm hoping we can get those educators to share that back with the community so that we can begin to develop some additional resources beyond the one very hacked together draft curriculum the team has put together. We'd love it if folks would run or host pilot workshops. I think it's to the point now where it can be done without a member from the Bytes team there, but we're also, there's 2.5 of us, and it's very part-time, so it's not like we have this big group, but I and my colleagues, when we can, love to go and run these workshops to get the firsthand feedback on how they go, but we're also happy to just provide, phone discussions on how it could go or how it went and incorporate feedback. And however you use it, let us know. We're still figuring this out and love feedback on the tool and on the curriculum. One open question that I'll just mention is maybe a cue for discussion. We've focused this so far on essentially targeted at college students in terms of the curriculum and how it goes and the level of independent work it encourages them to do. But we've also gotten a lot of suggestions that it could be turned into a slightly even simpler version, potentially for high school students or for more general public that's not as pre-interested in energy. So feedback on that, like what kinds of development avenues might make it useful for other uses, would be particularly good. So I think that's all I've got. I appreciate the questions so far, and I'd love to take any more from you guys now.
Is there any opportunity that you might educate Congress with this tool?
We've sent it to some staffers, actually, and there's a variety of people who use this to sort of gut check their own calculations now around DOE and I think other places as well. We don't take a very active role in engaging Congress just because of the way that our sort of existing constraints in terms of how DOE and how the lab are allowed to interact with Congress, but it potentially has use as a way to experiment with different options there as well, yeah.
I just think it's a terrific educational tool, and I wish, we're just now getting better at being able to visualize these very complex interactions and trade-offs. And it just seems like a terrific educational tool, and who knows, it might even be worthwhile bringing people who traditionally have very different viewpoints, getting them to play around with the options and see what happens.
So you just absolutely nailed with one of my big pipe dreams for this, which would be, let's get some people who know a lot about one sector but not others, so we can get some experts together and have them, use this as the basis for a workshop, right? And you could come up with it and say, these are these experts and this is the scenario they cooked up. I think that would be...
Yeah, and you could even do a bunch of groups, use the same model that you've... The model that you've designed is really wonderful, I think, for college level and for kids that are learning this stuff. But we need some folks out there right now who can go through this kind of process and model the kind of learning that we need for this century. We're kind of stuck right now.
So I agree with you. I think that is... Essentially, what your model does is it puts out there a way of informing one another in an interdisciplinary world. And, it puts a certain structure around it so that it's pretty easy. I mean, it's like the jigsaw exercises.
Yes.
And I've tried that for the first time this year in my course that I'm teaching, and the students really love it. And it's dynamic, and it keeps them engaged. And they learn something. So this would be great.
Austin, this is Scott again. I'm curious whether you formulated a series of challenges. This might be a way of doing a different kind of workshop where a certain kind of challenge is placed to the students in the various groups. And their goal is to create a scenario that would meet that challenge. And I'm wondering whether you've experimented with that notion to really sort of focus folks on what are the trade-offs. I mean, really push that to the trade-off, so they're seeing that more so than just sort of the playing around with it, see that it's very directed to meeting a particular challenge and essentially a reduction in energy use, for example.
Yeah, that's
something that's really tied to maybe sort of international agreements, things like that.
Well, I guess that kind of falls into a question that I had, which was, is policy part of this? Like, so for example, can you play with what would happen if we had a price on carbon? Or is it just sort of, if you could somehow devise a policy that would, have this impact, this is how it would trickle down to CO2 emissions?
Yes.
Because there's a pretty big step there that's, a whole other system, basically.
Exactly. So we've kept this away from price competition modeling that gets you into a whole level of additional modeling required, which there's the computational complexities, which is one thing, but we find that as soon as you go there, you get to you lose the intuition for how your inputs turn into outputs, right? So if I put a $50 price on carbon and then certain things change, you can sort of see what the model told you, but you don't necessarily understand why that's the case. So we've stayed away from doing that sort of modeling fairly intentionally. There's a number of tools that you can use to do that sort of analysis.
Yeah.
And we've really tried to not let ourselves, despite the temptation to want to do it, not jump into that arena, because it's sort of a whole different level of modeling complexity and then also nuance, and you have to then get a lot of things right to have credibility, whereas this, you're just showing a user what happens if they did something. So there's some policies out there that do translate pretty directly into this system. Like you could, for example, easily represent what a clean energy standard might do or a renewable electricity standard at the national level might do, or what the CAFE standards might accomplish. That would be fairly straightforward, but a price on carbon is just, we think, beyond the scope of this.
I like the idea of a challenge.
Yeah, so if I can turn back to Scott's suggestion on the challenge.
Has this been connected at all with the cycle of wedges? Because, you can make your own wedge.
Yes.
And actually design it so that you have, your own pie. So
Yeah, so the name Bytes actually is a little bit of a tongue-in-cheek reference to Wedge was an inspiration for this. Wedges have enormous power in communication usage, but they are often challenging in that they sort of all have to be the same size.
Yeah.
They don't interact with one another. So our goal here was to let you do things that wouldn't add up to a wedge, or that might be, you know, nine-sevenths of a wedge or
right.
other interaction, but not lose track of that great input-output simplicity of saying, if you do this, you will get this. So that's how we thought of it. I haven't talked to the Socklow Wedge people about it, but I would probably like to make them aware of it at some point. It's definitely been a part of the thinking on the communication to this tool.
You know, I think it would be very interesting, and just to carry on with the notion of the challenge, is if there were a couple of challenges like that placed up on the website to really encourage people to sort of develop scenarios that would meet those challenges. So it becomes more than just a workshop. It's something that really is a feature of the website itself, and folks can see how other folks have been able to meet those challenges.
Yeah, so that's a great suggestion. And one thing that we, and really good to hear, we're planning to hopefully implement is the ability when you create a new scenario to select a goal, and it could be type in your own or selected from a list, that when you go to the outputs, it would tell you not only how much of a reduction you had, but how you're doing on your goals.
Yes.
And then on the charts that you generate, if, for example, we went to benchmarking, in addition to showing us how we're doing, where the baseline was, we'd also maybe see a star that was the goal we'd selected.
Yeah.
Good.
That's something we think we do want to include.
Yeah, that would be very interesting.
I think that to do challenges really right, though, it's at its best when you have a group sort of self-policing on this. And when we do this in workshops, we've asked groups to select their own goal, and then that way they because if you just pick a goal, you can just dial up the sliders and hit it and say good for me, right? There's no constraints that keep you from doing it. But when you're working with other people, you provide your own sort of critics, and you can say, well, are you sure that getting that far is really the best way to do it? I thought maybe it would be doing this thing instead, which emphasizes that there's no right answer. You know, there's a lot of ways to get different places, and that there's different pros and cons of each of these potential options that we've got in there. But I agree. I think getting a better functionality behind a goal setting and then using that as the basis for challenges would be really, really good.
I think those ideas are really good for improving this, but I think that's not going to take very long with where you already are. My question is more, how are you going to get this out to everybody who can potentially use this? You talked about workshops that you have run. How many of you run, and what ideas do you have for scaling this up big time?
We did the lab and DOE equivalent of a mild fanfare about it. We had a progress alert out of DOE and an NREL press release just noting its existence. I think that's pretty paltry as far as actual outreach goes, but we're hoping that groups like this one can help spread the word about that it's out there as a potential tool, and I'm happy to get it out there. The workshops I've run are pretty much direct educational focus, so trying to refine this for educators' specific use case, but I think we have nothing telling us not to just get the word out there for anybody who might find it interesting otherwise.
So this is Mark McCaffrey with the National Center for Science Education. Are you familiar with the tool that the folks at NIST, the National Institute for Standards and Technology, have put together called BEES, which is kind of looking at life cycle and the embedded energy in different construction materials?
I knew that NIST had activity in that area, but I don't think I'm familiar with that specific tool. I'll check it out. Is that BEES, like BEES?
Yes.
I'll definitely check that out.
Yeah. I wonder if it might be possible to actually combine forces. What you're doing is very impressive, but what they're doing is kind of parallel and potentially very synergistic.
Mm-hmm.
Great, I'll follow up on that.
I can send you a link.
Sure.
Can you send that to everybody, Mark?
Sure.
Great. So are there any other questions for Austin? Because we're just getting close to the top of the hour. Certainly, I think, Austin, you left us your email address. We certainly can...
Great. Yeah, and if for anyone who wants to sort of stay up to date on stuff, we have a email list you can sign up for on the site. And you can always contact us either through this form or at bytes@nrel.gov goes to me and our developer, or you know, you have my personal email address. And if you're interested in the educational material, we've got a Bytes educators email list on this For Educators page, and we'll be posting some of these resources very soon. And if you want to see a version of them in draft form, feel free to let me know, and I can share that. I just want to keep it fairly contained until we're done with the editing and vetting of that.
Well, I can tell you, Austin, many of us are really interested in this work, so thank you for doing this. This is excellent.
No, I appreciate it. I appreciate the chance to talk about it. It's been a really fun project, and I'd love to get some use out there to be able to demonstrate, you know, why it was worthwhile to translate this tool out and get it out into the world.
Yep.
Well, thank you so much. This is totally excellent.
That's great. Austin, how do I get the a copy of the recording of the WebEx? I'd like to...
So you mean the recording I've been taking?
Yeah.
I will figure out how to get you one.
we'll work something out.
Okay.
Oh, one more question. Here's a thought for you on how to get this out there, and I don't have the details, but everything's going so online, and you're going to have the recording of the WebEx. So think about, given that we know the real interaction is group-oriented, how might that be facilitated using online educational media?
Uh-huh. Yep. So I totally agree. I think there's a bunch of really exciting groups and companies starting up now that are using online education as for courses, and I think that's a really cool idea.
There's Coursera, Harvard, MIT, GoForum. Go get them.
Yep.
Well, and also the ability to do the kind of thing we did this morning or this afternoon in terms of, you know, collectively being able to look at the same screen and to be able to, even as a group, to be able to put a scenario together. That certainly could be a group process, and it doesn't need to be done sort of face-to-face or in the same room. So.
Right.
Excellent, Austin. Thank you so much for this. Really appreciate it. And I just was going to wrap up and just remind folks that next week we're planning on having some discussion around the sessions we want to propose for the American Geophysical Union meeting, which is held usually in the early part of December in San Francisco. We've traditionally, as I think everyone knows, we've traditionally put in a number of session proposals and been very successful in getting those approved, and then we've filled them up with lots of interesting topics. So we want to continue to do that, and we'll use next week's conversation to put a few proposals together. So thank you for everyone, and hope you can join us next week. And thanks again to Austin for this.
Thanks a lot. Let me know if anybody has any thoughts following this call. I'm at your service.
Absolutely. Thank you so much again.
Thank you.
Bye. Thank you.
Bye,
everyone.
And thank you, Scott.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Bye.